I looked at him, lost in astonishment. There he was before me in motley, as though he had absconded from a troupe of mimes, enthusiastic, fabulous. His very existence was improbable, inexplicable, and altogether bewildering. He was an insoluble problem. It was inconceivable how he had existed, how he had succeeded in getting so far, how he had managed to remain, why he did not instantly disappear. "I went a little farther," he said, "then still a little farther, till I had gone so far that I don't know how I ever got back. Never mind. Plenty time. I can manage. You take Kurtz away, quick. Quick, I tell you." The glamour of youth enveloped his partly colored rags, his destitution, his loneliness, the essential desolation of his futile wanderings. For months, for years, his life hadn't been worth a day's purchase, and there he was, gallantly, thoughtlessly alive, to all appearances indestructible solely by the virtue of his few years and of his unreflecting audacity. I was seduced into something like admiration, like envy. Glamour urged him on. Glamour kept him unscathed. He surely wanted nothing from the wilderness but space to breathe in and to push on through. His need was to exist and to move onwards at the greatest possible risk and with a maximum of privation. If the absolutely pure, uncalculating, unpractical spirit of adventure had ever ruled a human being, it ruled this bepatched youth. I almost envied him the possession of this modest and clear flame. It seemed to have consumed all thought of self so completely that even while he was talking to you, you forgot that it was he, the man before your eyes, who had gone through these things. I did not envy him his devotion to Kurtz, though. He had not meditated over it. It came to him, and he accepted it with a sort of eager fatalism. I must say that to me it appeared about the most dangerous thing in every way he had come upon so far. They had come together unavoidably, like two ships becalmed near each other and lay rubbing sides at last. I suppose Kurtz wanted an audience, because on a certain occasion, when encamped in the forest, they had talked all night, or more probably Kurtz had talked. "We talked of everything," he said, quite transported at the recollection. "I forgot there was such a thing as sleep. The night did not seem to last an hour. Everything, everything, of love, too." "Ah, he talked to you of love," I said, much amused. "It isn't what you think," he cried, almost passionately. "It was in general. He made me see things, things." He threw his arms up. We were on deck at the time, and the head man of my woodcutters, lounging nearby, turned upon him his heavy and glittering eyes. I looked around. And I don't know why, but I assure you that never, never before did this land, this river, this jungle, the very arch of this blazing sky, appear to me so hopeless and so dark, so impenetrable to human thought, so pitiless to human weakness. "And ever since you have been with him, of course," I said. "On the contrary, it appears their intercourse had been very much broken by various causes. He had, as he informed me proudly, managed to nurse Kurtz through two illnesses." He alluded to it as you would to some risky feat. "But as a rule, Kurtz wandered alone, far in the depths of the forest. Very often, coming to this station, I had to wait days and days before he would turn up," he said. "Oh, it was worth waiting for. Sometimes." "What was he doing? Exploring or what?" I asked. "Oh, yes, of course. He had discovered lots of villages, a lake, too. He did not know exactly in what direction. It was dangerous to inquire too much. But mostly his expeditions had been for ivory.